Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Biography. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today we'll be talking with Owen McGee about his new biography of the Irish nationalist Arthur Griffith. Owen, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you, Mark.
I wonder if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
Well, I'm a historian, and I have a background in writing about the history of Irish nationalism. I wrote a book on Irish nationalism in the 19th century up until the beginning of a movement called Sinn Féin, which was started in the beginning of the 20th century. And as sort of a good follow-on from that, I decided to try and write a biography of Arthur Griffith, because he was effectively the founder and chief spokesman of the Sinn Féin movement up until the establishment of Irish independence in 1922. So that's sort of, you could say, is my background and my interest in the subject. I've studied history for many years. I did a PhD in history, but I also worked as an archivist and I worked in libraries and museums for a while. So I've always been very interested in Irish history.
Arthur Griffith seems to be a figure who doesn't enjoy the same degree of prominence as someone like, say, Eamon de Valera or Michael Collins. And I was wondering if that was something that you found was unwarranted given your research, as you were doing your research into the biography.
Perhaps, but I think an issue with Arthur Griffith, certainly when compared to an individual like Eamon de Valera or Michael Collins, is that he wasn't a very glamorous figure. Griffith was respected by many contemporaries for what he wrote, but in politics, he wasn't necessarily someone with great charisma. And in an Irish context, de Valera certainly had that. Michael Collins, to a significant degree, although he was nearly more famous for his reputation more than anything else, sort of as a freedom fighter or something like that. But Arthur Griffith would belong among those who effectively considered the pen mightier than the sword. So he was a leading spokesman for the independence movement. But he was probably the least charismatic.
And in reading your book, it really comes across the degree to which how more important, if you will, or visible that role was in the pre-independence period. Here I'm talking about the period of the British control over Ireland in the late 19th and early 20th centuries when Griffith first establishes his career.
Yes, that's true. And I guess for historians of Ireland, there can be a tendency to romanticize that period leading up to independence. The same thing can apply really with the history of any country. I'm sure in America, a lot of people continue to pay attention to people like George Washington and the supposed founding fathers of the state. They may not have had great relevance in terms of what happened afterwards, but yet because they were seen as one of the founding fathers, they're sort of larger than life figures. Mm-hmm. That can certainly apply in terms of the reputation that people like Griffith and Collins had, and of course Eamon de Valera lived for many years afterwards, and he almost became an icon of the Irish state as a result, because he was around for so long.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could speak a bit about Griffith's childhood and his family background, because he doesn't come from very substantial circumstances. And he has, as you describe, a career where he really has to struggle to establish himself early on.
Yes, that's very much true. I mean, he was born in the inner city of Dublin, which is Ireland's largest city, but it was very much a depressed city at the time with great poverty. So, for instance, Arthur Griffith's own father and I believe his uncle both spent time in workhouses, which were like the poor houses for people who could not support themselves. His sister died of tuberculosis, which was contracted because of slum living conditions that he grew up among. And that happened to some of his closest friends as well. So poverty was a major issue in, I would say, Arthur Griffith's life when he was growing up and into his young adulthood. And you could say right up until he earned sort of a name in the political world for coming up with and writing his pamphlet, Come Book, The Sinn Féin Policy. He started to get noticed then, and he had more of a career, or he started to have a career as the editor of, they weren't quite newspapers, they were more like reviews, you know, like there were weekly magazines in effect that covered all the most topical issues of the day and the most notable books that were coming out and the most notable political ideas that people had. He became a figure in the whole, you know, you could call it like the Republic of Letters or whatever. Like he was, that's what sort of allowed him to find a niche, I guess you could say, both in terms of politics and also in the world of the press, in effect, you know?
The analogy that I had in my mind as I was reading the book, since you referenced America, the United States' own revolutionary history, is Benjamin Franklin, in the sense that Griffith doesn't really have much of an opportunity for an education, but he goes into printing, which, as you mentioned, his father, whose name is also Arthur Griffith, does as well, and how printing was for the working classes an opportunity to really develop oneself literarily.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. To some extent, you know, people have said that printers were merely envied by other, say, working class people at the time for their levels of literacy and so on, but also for their capacity maybe to, through their mastery over the written word or to move in different circles within society. And if they were well able to express themselves, their intelligence would get recognized. So I suppose if you took somebody like Benjamin Franklin, he was well known for writing pamphlets or books like the Means and Manner of Obtaining Virtue. Mm-hmm. And in so doing, people could see, well, this was a virtuous man, in effect, or at least he knew what that idea meant. And so people could admire and respect him and maybe want to hear more of what he had to say. Mm-hmm. And in the same way, Griffith would be somebody who, through his capacity to write and publish, he earned a name or a reputation that most of people of his social background simply did not have at that time.
Now, was he pulled into printing, or was he pushed into it by his father?
I would say he was pushed into it by his father. I mean, it's nearly a cliche to say, but at that time, society was maybe very patriarchal. It was like father, like son, and particularly in the professions at all levels in society, you tended to have people would literally follow the family trade, mm-hmm. the family profession. You know, a lot of doctors were sons of doctors. A lot of printers were sons of printers. It just seemed to work that way, I guess, primarily for the issue of security. Because if you were someone poor, like Griffith was growing up, well, unless you had a trade, you would be nearly guaranteed to end up in the poorhouse. So I wouldn't be inclined to say that it that stood to him, his training as a printer, so much as the fact that he was sort of a self-educated figure who really trained himself, or if that's the right word, nurtured himself as a writer. When he was young, he didn't necessarily write that well, but by virtue of the fact that he was attempting to edit a weekly publication and write editorials every week and so on, he got better and better, and partly as a result, he was able to make better arguments or more influential arguments.
And that ties back into the importance of being a printer, which is you simply have the experience of writing and editing and composing, and that process is how you hone one's skill as a writer, much in the same way that some of the other skills are more about practice and development rather than some sort of innate genius.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah, like he was being grafted is a good phrase. You know, you learn by doing, and nobody is a natural born genius, is an old saying. You know, it's all hard work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The other thing that comes across in your chapter on his early years is how early he comes to his politics. And I was wondering if you could speak a bit to his involvement in Irish nationalist politics during those teenage years, where he seems to be not only active at an early age, but he seems to attain positions of surprising prominence for someone who is, you know, merely a teenager.
Yeah, you could say that. On the other hand, it's a curious aspect of Victorian society, you could say, in Britain and Ireland, that one thing that people were encouraged to do at an early age was to get involved in debating societies and the like as a means of developing their abilities, maybe after they had left school or while they were still attending school. And the strange thing, perhaps, about them is that they were organized almost like political clubs. For instance, if there was a debate to be held and you were to chair the debate, it might have been on a political subject, or people might have to play, do kind of role playing. Okay, you're the Prime Minister this week, and what do you say about this issue? So that was actually something that was common when Griffith was growing up in the 1880s and 1890s in Britain and Ireland. Partly because I think it was around that time, partly due to the growth of the press. You had new newspapers being set up, particularly for working people and so on, in the 1880s. And the politicians of the day really for the first time started to become like celebrities. Everyone had some opinion on politics and so on, because everyone knew who the leading politicians were. That you could, when you had sort of debating societies set up, they were almost like political speaking clubs, and that had a role in society at that time, almost like say the equivalent of a prominent politician having become a prominent member of a debating society if he went to a college or university. It was the same skill exercised in a different forum. And it could have been a ladder to get into politics, usually through the field of journalism, in effect, or maybe local politics. Like, you know, it wouldn't necessarily make you a political leader, but it certainly gets you involved in the political process. And that's sort of what happened in Griffith's case.
And yet, as you describe, the environment of local politics was very different than it was in Great Britain during this time. And you spend a considerable amount of space in your book describing that context, given that it's very important to understand how Britain developed. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about it as well. What was going on in terms of Irish nationalist politics, and also the constraints that not just Griffith, but other Irish nationalists face in terms of promoting their cause, both in the political realm and in the practical realm of local governance, which was much more restricted than it was at that time in Victorian Britain.
Yes, you could say that, certainly. It would have been, I think, in 1888, a law was passed in Britain, which meant that a significant percentage of the Treasury's funds would be reinvested in municipal or city governments and county governments, all for the sake of developing towns in Britain. Many historic towns actually became cities just at that time period as a direct result of that process. But that same legislation did not apply within Ireland. And for somebody like Griffith, who grew up in Dublin, which had been like in the past, a home of an Irish parliament and something like a capital city, the fact that it had become a depressed city and also had been denied this sort of level of funding from a central government was one of his great motives to be in favor of the setting up of an Irish government. And you could say, too, from that basis that for, say, people who were growing up in more rural areas in Ireland, they weren't necessarily, even if they could understand that same principle about maybe lack of funding for things in Ireland, they weren't necessarily as preoccupied with sort of national political questions. And so Griffith's perspective was very much shaped by his standing as a someone from Dublin or a Dubliner. And, you know, but in the countryside, people might not have been on exactly the same wavelength when it came to politics. Griffith, to them, might have seemed almost like, a Dublin patriot rather than being the sort of Irish nationalist that they would identify with, because his worldview was very much shaped by the fact that he was from Dublin and wanted it to become a prosperous capital city of Ireland once more.
That was a dimension of his life that I must confess I had not been aware of before I read your book, which was the degree to which he was not just an Irish patriot, but very much of a Dublin patriot. And it was very had a very deep and a love for his the city in which he grew up.
Yeah, and that's partly why the well-known writer James Joyce, who wrote his first collection of short stories and entitled it Dubliners, Joyce, on leaving Dublin, he used to subscribe to Griffith's publication. He kind of identified with the arguments that were Griffith published. So all through the years that James Joyce, say, was living in Paris, he was a subscriber to Griffith's review, and that kind of was his connection to what was going on back in Ireland. And of course, Joyce was from Dublin too, so he kind of maybe knew or identified with some of Griffith's arguments for that reason. And, even when he came to write his famous Ulysses novel, the character Leo Bloom, there's some hints in there that he's in some way closely associated to Arthur Griffith's circle in Dublin. An underclass of, I suppose this fits into the Irish, the subject of Irish nationalism. There was a sense in Ireland at the time that you had a lot of these people who could have been living in Dublin who were very intelligent, well-educated, even if they were possibly just self-educated, but they lived in a in an atmosphere of frustration, because it was like as if they had talents and they didn't have a means to use them or an outlet to use them. And then partly from that, that trend in Irish society, people associated Arthur Griffith with the type of person who in response to that situation was saying, well, Irish independence automatically will be a cure for all these problems. So that sort of built up an expectation then when Griffith later became prominent if he was going to be able to fulfill those types of promises. And that was easier said than done.
It was another level was that sense of the inability to attain opportunities a factor in why he traveled to South Africa at the end of the century?
Yeah, there was a number of different stories which were effectively rumors as to why he went to South Africa in his late 20s. And none of them can actually be verified because he never actually formally, you know, stated or put it in writing, oh, I went to South Africa for this reason. But I think it's pretty clear that poverty was the issue. He went to South Africa right before the outbreak of the Boer War, and there was the Anglo-Boer War, that is, and there was the rumor was, and fairly well-founded rumor, that there was a lot of money to be made in South Africa at that time. So you have people both from in Ireland and in Britain who went to South Africa in the 1890s as basically hoping to be able to make some money. And so that in Griffith's case, that would be to escape from poverty. He worked in South Africa just as a foreman in a gold mine. It wouldn't have been paid very well, but he actually acquired his first editorial experience in South Africa for some small local paper. He was only involved with that for a few months, but it would have given him a good sense of what it was like to be directly involved in the newspaper business. And it was, in fact, it was after he came back from South Africa that, for the first time, he set up his own newspaper or review.
That was one of the things that really stood out for me was how that was, in a sense, an opportunity that he may not have had at quite that young of an age in Ireland, in the sense of being able to do that for himself. And as you point out, it didn't necessarily end very well for him. You described the incident that led to his dismissal and you know, brought his helped to bring his time in South Africa to an early end.
Yeah. And another strange or a strange thing about that situation would be that the means that he had to get to South Africa, he sort of was able to work through sort of a number of Irish clubs that existed both in South Africa and in Ireland. And these sort of Irish clubs would have been, at the time, they effectively existed directly because of the existence of the British Empire. In effect, wherever the Empire had spread, Irish people could end up living there just like the way English people might be living there. But but these Irish clubs tended to be also mixed up with sort of a revolutionary underground. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of the initial platform that Griffith became associated with. There was an underground movement that was later responsible for the 1916 Rising, called the Irish Republican Brotherhood, or IRB, and Griffith was mixed up in that from an early age. And in effect, as reflected by his friendship with, or later friendship with Michael Collins, who was the last leader of the IRB when they both died in 1922, he sort of maintained that association all along. So I don't know if you would say that meant he was on the left of Irish politics at the time, or the right, or whatever, but he was on the sort of the revolutionary margins, sort of a nationalist revolutionary, the revolutionary nationalist wing of Irish public opinion at the time. That's the way Griffith's contemporaries would have identified him. That was sort of the place that he occupied within Irish political debate, up until and after the formation of Sinn Féin. That was in 1905.
I'd like to talk a bit about after he comes back to Ireland in 1898, and how he quickly begins to involve himself in both editing and turning his editorship to a platform for Irish politics. You've been talking a bit about these journals that he's been editing. I was wondering if you could walk us through his early journals and their prominence and their whom their audience was.
Right. Well, his first journal was called The United Irishman, and it was set up in 1899. And it, at that time, was effectively, secretly, the organ of the IRB, Revolutionary Underground. And it was quite small in its early years. It opposed the British war effort in South Africa during the Boer War. That made it sort of a controversial organ. And it took off or became more noticed around 1904. That was the time when Griffith published a series of articles in the United Irishman that then was reprinted as a book that sold very well, called The Resurrection of Hungary. And the key thing about that was its argument that what Irish nationalists would need to do in order to claim independence was to withdraw its political representatives from the Imperial Parliament in Westminster and effectively unilaterally set up an Irish Parliament in Dublin and force Britain to recognise in the process that Ireland was a historic and distinct kingdom in itself, or a distinct nation in itself, and it had a right to the self-government. Because that also essentially became the basis of the Sinn Féin policy, which its distinguishing feature was it justified the same argument almost entirely from an economic point of view. And once Arthur Griffith started making those arguments, he launched a new journal called Sinn Féin, and that remained in print right up until the outbreak of the First World War in 1914.
He doesn't seem to have had a very large audience, as you point out, that sometimes his press runs were roughly 1,000, and his target audience seemed to have been really very focused on men who were like him. These, as you described, these bookish members of the working class. And yet he, as you point out, James Joyce read his journal. Was that a reflection of his arguments, or was that a reflection of his writing style? What exactly, you know, allowed him to attain that degree of prominence?
Well, I think if you think of these publications as review publications, where they were like, they might have had some good original material in them, and at the same time, they would have been a review of all other notable publications at the time. These publications wouldn't necessarily have, or they certainly weren't printed in the same number of copies as commercial newspapers of the day. You know, they could, I'm not sure about the exact number of figures, but, you know, could be tens of thousands and so on. They would have been more successful publications and ones that more people would have read. But I think the very fact that Griffith's publications were reviews, that they weren't just the reports of the regular news items of the day, that gave them an appeal to people who were fond of reading similar types of journals. For instance, at the time, say if Griffith's publications were only printed in 1,000 or 2,000 copies, well, a lot of those copies might have been read by university students at the time who might otherwise be, you know, buying the college journal or looking up academic journals, whether they identified with Griffith's arguments or not, it'd be very hard to say. But the very fact that the format of his publication, it was a sort of item that people might have been inclined, or those people might have been inclined to read anyway. So I'd say, as you mentioned, his principal audience might have been like the bookish section of the working class population. But I'd say you could have people right across the literary world or the academic world or whatever. They probably were familiar with his publication, read it fairly frequently, and so on. So somebody like another well-known figure, apart from James Joyce, would have been W.B. Yeats. And he used to read Griffith's publication and he'd follow its arguments, and it had become a subject point then of debate in his own circles. You know, they mightn't have agreed with Griffith, but they'd be talking about what he had written or what had appeared in this publication, and were considering whether that was an indication of a new direction for public opinion in the country.
It's interesting you should mention Yeats, because I was struck by going to the literary side about how one of the things about a review journal versus a commercial journal is that they tend to bear more of the imprint of the editor. He tends to have more of a wide-ranging influence on what's printed and oftentimes what's written. You mentioned that he tended to steer away from art, but in the in 1907, he comes out against the Playboy of the Western World, which was J.M. Sign. It was a very controversial play at the time, and you would think that, you know, on the one hand, as you mentioned, being a man of the left, Griffith would support it, and yet Griffith was part of this moral condemnation about it. And you also, and what I thought was fascinating about it, was how you tie it to his personal life in his courtship with his wife, this very extended courtship that you described. And I was wondering if you could talk a bit about that and how that influenced in his relationship with his, at the time, you know, longstanding girlfriend, and how that and that aspect of his life that was very, I don't want to say quite say stunted, but definitely limited.
Yeah. Well, I'd say if you wanted to contrast Griffith's background or upbringing with that of the woman who became his wife. His wife came from a much more kind of middle class background and a much more sort of religious background. And Griffith, I wouldn't describe him as having ever been an anti-religious figure, but like a lot of working class people in Britain and Ireland in the Victorian times and afterwards, they'd sort of, for material reasons, in effect, they'd become very disenchanted with organized religion to a significant degree. You know, the popularity of the Church of England, say, in England went down the tubes nearly in the mid to late Victorian period. Ordinary people sort of came more distant from religion. And I say, what's that got to do with the issues you described there? Well, as first of all, I would say with Griffith and his relationship with his wife is that because she was so religious, he was hoping to develop a good relationship there. He had to be very tolerant and respectful of her opinions and maybe nurture whatever sort of religious sense he had himself. I think that was a factor in their relationship. And then outside of that, you could say that... I mean, it's nearly a cliche to say in Ireland that, for people to say about Ireland that, you know, religion nearly played too prominent a role in things. But an issue or an episode, rather, like the boycott of the Playboy of the Western World, that was actually organized by, on religious type of moral grounds, by people like who were involved in University College Dublin, which was a sort of a new Catholic university in Ireland at the time, and also there was an Irish language movement at the time that had the patronage of the churches and so on. That language movement, it was called the Gaelic League, and it actually kind of led that boycott. And even though Griffith had been very opposed to any idea of people attempting to censure literary productions in the past, at that particular time, in order to keep his own publication afloat, he needed to rely on the subscriptions of people who were very much tied into that kind of religious movement at the time that was really in effect sympathetic towards censorship of literature and so on. So like that's partly, I mean, people who are familiar with episodes in the life of individuals like Yeats and Joyce would know how deeply that could affect people at the time. Yeats acted sort of as a critic of that process. James Joyce was nearly driven out of his tree by that type of public opinion in Ireland at the time. And that was actually one of his motives for emigrating, you know? Mm-hmm. So it was an unusual time, perhaps, you know, in the UK context, you'd refer to it as the Edwardian period, the 1900s, 1900 to 1910. At that time, there was just kind of, there was almost like a moral fervor movement in Ireland. And in fact, most of the modern day cathedrals or Catholic cathedrals in Ireland were all built at that time. And actually, that's actually a strange way with Griffith's career. Griffith was always arguing that everyone should be supporting financially or otherwise Irish nationalist causes. Instead of that, everyone was sort of just kept on pushing for religious causes, setting up religious private schools, building cathedrals, getting Westminster to be more sympathetic towards religion in general across the UK, that type of thing. And Griffith was never too happy about that. And but it formed a context for his career, you know, because I think people who later on that he became associated with when Sinn Féin became more popular, an example there would be somebody like Eamon de Valera. Somebody like de Valera very much came, you know, sort of got into politics because of those causes. He didn't become involved in things initially out of some kind of dogmatic or fundamentalist nationalist aspiration for self-government or a nationalist revolution or anything like that. So those two kind of elements of public opinion coexisted, you could say, throughout Griffith's lifetime.
It seems that that navigation between those two is especially important in the period between, say, 1906 and 1914, because that focus in part seems to reflect how the impetus was with the whole Home Rule movement, what was happening in Westminster initially with the victory of the Liberal Party in 1906, and then more significantly the elections in 1910, which gave the Irish nationalists the difference in terms of the balance of Parliament. So it was it seemed in that period for Griffith, it was a difficult time. It seemed as though that his vision was less likely to be achieved, and that it was more of a struggle for him to keep it afloat, to keep his newspapers going, to keep his, more importantly, his cause going.
Yes, I think that was true. And it's sort of probably a frustrating thing for Griffith at that time was that in several respects, you could say he nearly made some of his best political arguments at that time by focusing very much on the idea that the Home Rule cause could not and certainly was not going to result in the granting of any kind of fiscal autonomies to Ireland. And Griffith really teased out that idea at the time in his writings. And he made a fairly good job at that. But at the same time, like you said, the very fact that the Irish politicians in Westminster were able to achieve the balance of power, say, in the House of Commons in 1910, that is what caught people's attention or became the subject of people's focus. And as a result, even though Griffith was making some very good arguments at the time, and arguments that might have grown popular at a later date, they didn't necessarily get the audience that he might have hoped at that time. So if you're familiar with a lot of our common arguments regarding 20th century Irish history, is that the outbreak of the First World War really was a big turning point, because from that time onwards, the Home Rule cause was seemingly dead in the water, and therefore the sort of arguments that people like Arthur Griffith were making started to come find their audience, and became a new platform for people to mobilize on.
What happens to Griffith as a political figure during the First World War?
Well, on one hand, he keeps focused on sustaining his publications. He set up a new journal called Nationality. But there was obviously, during wartime, there's always press censorship. And so Griffith's publications had a very hard time keeping afloat during the First World War. And then maybe a decisive turning point in some respects is that many of his colleagues in the IRB decided to take advantage of the existence of a rump volunteer movement in Ireland that decided not to enlist in the British war effort when the First World War broke out. That rump volunteer movement, the British government was going to suppress it, and the Griffith's friends in the IRB decided, well, before they can do that, let's try and get these volunteers to stage a nationalist rebellion. And that's why the 1916 Rising happened. So at that time, the same people who were behind the 1916 Rising were also funding Griffith's journal. But Griffith wasn't directly involved in the Rising. But he was imprisoned as a result of the Rising. And you could say once there was sort of a reaction in Ireland to the fact that the rebel leaders were executed, Griffith's Sinn Féin cause became the new platform for people who felt a sense of outrage against the British government for not only executing those rebels, but also to introduce internment without trial. Like, there was hundreds of people put in prison during 1916. The protest vote went to Sinn Féin, and as a result, when Griffith revived his Nationality publication in 1917, it had a big readership for the first time. And it's really from that time onwards that the Sinn Féin party that existed for about 10 years, it only from that time onwards started to become a successful political party. And that's what right at the very end of the First World War, you know, the Armistice Day and so on, that coincided with the holding of a UK-wide general election. And it was in that election that the Sinn Féin candidates, who accepted Griffith's policy of withdrawing from Westminster and unilaterally setting up an Irish parliament in Dublin, those Sinn Féin candidates won the majority of those seats. That was the basis from which then the effort to set up an Irish parliament or government named Dáil Éireann took place in 1919.
And even before the general election in November 1918, Griffith had already been elected to the Westminster Parliament in a by-election. And so he was able to... And it was fascinating how you tie that into the stature that he has by virtue of being a prisoner, that it helps to racist profile even further. It establishes his bona fides as a Sinn Féin leader.
Yes, and at that time, as strange as it might seem, because of the number of imprisonments that had taken place in the country, that it could actually serve as a popularity booster to have served time in prison. You know, an Irish nationalist spirit or movement or whatever had sort of grown strong in the country at that time, and with that, there was a lot of sympathy for those who had been imprisoned, and particularly because they not only were people being imprisoned without trial, but you could, for instance, you mentioned the case there of Griffith having been elected at a by-election, so he was an elected parliamentary representative, but he was still imprisoned without trial for simply for his political views. So that was bound to lead to a response whereby people decided to protest very strongly about this and make very serious moves to make a stand for full Irish self-government. So this type of thing, it was hoped could not happen again.
What was Griffith's role in the Dáil? I mean, was he early on a prominent parliamentary speaker? And what role did he play in terms of setting up the Irish administration that the Dáil sought to organize?
Well, he was really a central figure. He was initially made the Minister for Home Affairs, which that meant, in effect, like a minister for justice and for policing and so on. But he also served as the acting president of the Dáil Éireann Assembly. And in that capacity, he had a role to play, a coordinating role to play, both within what became the cabinet of Dáil Éireann, and he also became a spokesman for its cause nationally and as much as was possible internationally. An idea that Griffith had, even at the very beginning of the Sinn Féin policy, was that it would be important to send Irish representatives abroad in order to get international sympathy for the idea of Irish independence. So one of the very first things that Griffith did as acting president of the Dáil was to encourage sending of representatives of the Dáil abroad. So that was done to like France and Germany, Italy, Spain, the United States. There was even attempts to send representatives to South America. Some old friends of Griffith who had emigrated to Canada many years before, they formed a supporting movement and so on. So they were all kind of tentative steps taken at that time to try and establish a profile for an Irish government or state in abroad or internationally. And Griffith was, you could nearly say, the key figure in organizing all that. And, of course, Eamon de Valera, who was the nominal president of the Dáil at the time, he spent nearly 2 years in the United States trying to champion that same policy to win international sympathy for the cause of Irish independence. And that was tied in also very much to the way Irish politicians understood the situation. They were inclined to focus on Woodrow Wilson's idea of a League of Nations. So if Ireland could get admitted to that, that would be a way of guaranteeing an independent identity, political identity for an Irish state.
That relationship with Eamon de Valera seems to have been an especially important one. And I was wondering if you could speak to a bit about that relationship and why it was that ultimately that De Valera chose Griffith to lead the negotiating team that went to London in 1921 to negotiate the Anglo-Irish Treaty.
Right. Well, as an extension of the type of activities I was describing there a few minutes ago, trying to promote an international identity or profile for the Irish government to be, Griffith had been made, or De Valera actually appointed Griffith as the Dáil Éireann's Minister for Foreign Affairs. So in that capacity, that is an explanation, in effect, for why Griffith would be someone chosen to head an attempt to negotiate, from the Irish point of view, an international treaty. Griffith and De Valera were friends, and they certainly got on quite well with each other. De Valera used to say, even when he was in America, that Griffith is kind of like was the best guide, really, for Irish nationalists to follow at the time in terms of what's the best policy was to take. But I think De Valera, before he had sent Griffith to London to negotiate an Anglo-Irish treaty, he had been involved with negotiations with London himself. And what I think one of the reasons why there was a divide in opinion over even the idea of an Anglo-Irish treaty was that from the Irish point of view, it was believed that even if Britain signed an agreement that seemed to grant Ireland independence, they were far from sure, in light of the very coercive actions Britain had taken in recent times, they were far from sure that Britain would actually honour that agreement or honour that treaty. And so even though De Valera had attempted to negotiate a treaty himself, he had the inkling, you could say, that no matter what treaty was signed, Britain probably would not abide by it. So that's actually, like for instance, if as you're probably aware, Griffith, on going to London after a couple of months' negotiation, he signed a treaty whereby the Irish government was to become an Irish free state with similar autonomies to those enjoyed by Canada or Australia. Griffith interpreted that as meaning effectively pretty much full autonomy.
The realization of his vision going back to his early years in the nationalist movement.
Yeah, well, some people made that connection between those two things. But an issue is that with the agreement, as part of the agreement, one of the provisions was that there was to be sort of an interim provisional government in place. And it would take at least a year after the signing of the treaty before Westminster would consider giving its formal consent to the treaty. So, in effect, what that situation created was that from throughout the whole year of 1922, from the Dáil voting in favour of the treaty at the beginning of January to Westminster's nominal acceptance of it in December 22, through that whole year, there was huge uncertainty whether the agreement was going to go through. Like, it's almost like, I hate making contemporary parallels, but it's almost like people today trying to figure out what type of treaty is Britain going to negotiate with the EU now that it's left the EU. This hasn't happened before. We don't know how this is going to work. Well, in effect, during 1922, that's what the whole of Ireland was saying. And so Griffith, in effect, in having signed the treaty, he had to shoulder the responsibility for trying to navigate the way through that uncertainty And De Valera adopted the perspective of, well, I'm willing to bet this isn't going to work. You know, there's different arguments of whether he was right in that or not, but it was certainly an understandable situation or stance for people to take at the time, simply because of the uncertainty. And, of course, in addition to the fact that Britain had adopted such severe coercive tactics in the very recent past, another issue for people was that Griffith argued that, and he was sort of right in theory on this, that the treaty could grant Ireland or allow Ireland to exercise fiscal autonomies. One reason why it was liable not to work that way is that Britain, of course, had included or had already passed an act to bring about the partition of Ireland, creating Northern Ireland. And why was that significant? Well, Griffith, in talking about fiscal autonomies, was talking about nationalizing various institutions, nationalizing the railways, nationalizing the banks, and so on. But the problem with that was is that if the Dáil Éireann government decided to introduce those policies, that would naturally bring Belfast or Northern Ireland's sort of heartland more under Dublin's economic orbit than London's economic orbit, because they would have the same banking system, the same transport system, and so on. So it actually became Griffith's downfall, in effect, that he was arguing in public, and he was actually arguing in private in his negotiations with the British government that, yes, we have the right to nationalise various financial institutions within Ireland. That very suddenly, it was in June of 1922, Westminster turned around and says, no, you absolutely cannot do that. And there's no way in the world we're going to allow an Irish government to be set up that can do that, because an Irish government first has to recognise that they can't adopt any policies that will adversely affect the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. So nationalising things would have created, nearly undone the partition settlement. So Griffith, in effect, got brushed aside in Michael Collins too because of that reaction of the British government in the summer of 1922. And then a conflict broke out in Ireland right there and then. It's usually referred to as the Irish Civil War. Some people have been inclined to blame people like De Valera for that, but they thought the fact that he was opposing the agreement created this situation. The other argument would be is that De Valera actually kind of figured out or knew that this was what was going to happen, because for whatever agreement that Dublin signed with London, it would not grant Ireland the right to disrupt London's plans for the economy of the UK, including Northern Ireland. So that was kind of Griffith's final downfall, and he died within a week or 10 days of Michael Collins in August 1922.
Yeah. Although, unlike Collins, he didn't die as a result of the fighting. He collapsed. Basically, he worked himself to death.
Well, that was a view that was expressed, that, you know, Griffith had worked so hard to keep the Dáil Éireann government afloat, even when Britain didn't recognize it and the international community, in effect, didn't recognize it. He was working so hard at that for over 3 years and suffered periods of imprisonment in there as well, that he literally died of exhaustion. That may be true, but it was also rumored at the time, you can't pay too much attention to rumors, but it was literally a case that he became the odd man out within his own cabinet, along with Collins, and the British cabinet were saying to Dublin that, well, these guys have to go, in effect. So from that perspective, some people thought that he was you know, that he fell ill very suddenly, was hospitalized for a month before he formally dropped dead. Some people thought there must have been some foul play involved there. But, you know, with these situations, that I guess kind of mythologies can build up around things like that. I didn't go into that in my own book at all. I didn't sort of, focusing on those kind of almost conspiracy theories that were at the time. But certainly in just a plain and regular party political sense, it was clear kind of by December of 22 that Griffith's kind of party political policy, the old Sinn Féin policy of claiming fiscal autonomy, maybe it could have been adopted a few years down the road, but it was not going to be possible to start implementing there and then, because as far as London was be concerned, it would be far too disruptive. Everything had to evolve on a much slower pace, you know?
And the tragedy is that he never, I mean, he didn't, you know, not only did he not achieve the full measure of his vision for what Ireland could become, but he, in the end, doesn't even live to see the practical acquisition of the Irish Free State and that step forward. I mean, it was clearly in the cards. He knew it was going to come, but he died just short of that becoming a reality.
Yeah, and so like the Free State was sort of nominally came into being in December 1922. Griffith had died 4 months earlier. It took until, say, 1924 until the Irish Free State was recognized by any international power. The first power to do so was the United States, which was had been an aspiration of Griffith and De Valera and others. It was the same week that the United States recognized the Free State, which was in October 1924, that was the same week that the Irish government was able to formally establish its own army, really on its feet for the first time. The army that's there to this day, the Defence Forces, it's known as, it was formally established in the same week as the United States recognised the Irish Free State. And even after that, the whole issue about getting a civil service on its feet within the country and so on. That nearly didn't, you could say, that didn't really occur till 1927 or thereabouts. So that's like nearly 5 years after Griffith died. So, yeah, it's that's one of the challenges really for historians when they look at somebody like Griffith or Michael Collins. They say, okay, these people were like, seem to be the first leaders of an independent Irish government, but they were actually dead long before the government really got on its feet. And so then when people start thinking, well, what was the legacy of these people? That becomes a difficult question to answer.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Well, I've written another historical study. This is just a short article, in effect, but it's actually on the theme of the attempt to establish an independent or foreign policy for an independent Irish state from the beginnings of the Dáil up until 1927. I mean, it's just a short survey, but it focuses on the ideas that people like Griffith and others, De Valera and so on, had about what kind of role did Ireland want to play in international relations. So there's sort of a key document there that the Dáil Éireann issued right at its inception in 1919. It was called the Message to the Free Nations of the World. Yeah, it was like a Declaration of Independence. But it actually embodied within it a particular vision of what role Ireland could play in international relations and how that could be of benefit to Europe and to America, and how that differed from its envisioned policy differed from the traditional British foreign policy regarding Europe or even America. So it's sort of teasing out the ideas that existed in Ireland at that time regarding what type of foreign policy an independent Irish government would actually want to take.
It sounds not just like an interesting article, but a very timely one as well, considering what's happening today with regard to Ireland, Britain, and Europe.
Maybe, but it's my inspiration for it was really the fact that I had written the book on Griffith, and after I had written it and it was published, I said to myself, "Oh, gee, I forgot to focus nearly on the foreign policy angle and the fact that I didn't even quote from this message to the free nations of the world in my book, but it really was sort of a key document, and but it's not. There hasn't been much written hitherto in Ireland on that type of theme, so I'm not too pleased with the article. Worthwhile writing, and at the same time, I would say to anyone who's particularly interested in that theme, there was a book done 10 years ago called by a woman named Bernadette Whelan, called The United States Foreign Policy in Ireland from 1913 to 1929. She really teases out there how the fortunes of the Irish campaign to set up an independent foreign policy, what fortunes that had in America, and why America's response ultimately became the most significant one in terms of the Irish state being able to get on its feet. So it's that's an interesting subject in itself. I don't barely touch on it in my article, but it's a good subject.
Sounds like it. Well, Owen McGee, thank you very much for your time. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Okay, thank you, Mark. Thanks very much.